You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and this is our first live show of 2018, which is... See, January 2018, the first January. We started the show in October of 2006, so we're into our 12th year here. And normally, I'd be introducing my mother right about now, my co-host, Caroline Kilborn, but she was iced in Mount Pleasant today. Her driveway was a sheet of ice, and at her age, it's not worth tempting fate by trying to get through an icy driveway. So, I'm flying solo today. But we have a great and very interesting guest with a very interesting book. Stephen Doster is the author of OMG, Don Quixote and Candide Seek Truth, Justice, and El Dorado in the Digital Age, LOL. And Stephen was raised, according to, he this book was done under a pseudonym, Stephen Soto. And it says that Stephen Soto was raised by a Romani princess and a Ukrainian circus performer. He resides on an English canal and has no known address. His early works were banned by most right-thinking European powers. And I have a feeling that Stephen Doster has a slightly different bio. So welcome to Writers' Voices, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about... you and your counterpart, Stephen Soto, and why you chose to publish under this name.
Well, I was born in England, like Stefan, or no, he's from Romania, apparently.
Apparently.
I came to the U.S. In the early 1960s, landed in Alabama, which was a bit of a culture shock to... at least to my brothers and sisters and me, and moved to Georgia from there, and now I live in Tennessee. But I'm a big fan of Don Quixote. In 2003, I went to a bookstore here and asked the Roger Bishop, who worked there at Davis Kidd Booksellers, I need some something good to read, something classic literature. He handed me Don Quixote without even thinking about it. And immediately got hooked and wrote a similar book, my first book, through John F. Blair Publisher, and been thinking about Don Quixote ever since. Wanted to get him on the road and matched him up with Candide, another character I like. And my first publisher, in one of the catalogs, misspelled my name. They spelled it, instead of D-O-S-T-E-R, it's D-S-O-T-E-R. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. I like that. And so when I was thinking of a name for this book, because Cervantes, who wrote Don Quixote, and Voltaire, who wrote Candide, both used pseudonyms at some point. In fact, Voltaire is a pseudonym for the author's real name. And so I decided in honor of them, I would use a non-diplume for this book. That's how Stephen Soto came about.
And so you mentioned that you have published a previous book. And what other writing and publishing have you done?
I don't count them, but I think I have seven other books. Two are oral histories of Georgia, and one short story collection, and then a couple other novels.
And why don't you count them?
I haven't really thought about it. Seven or eight. I think I'm at seven or eight.
Okay, so you don't number them. It's not that they don't count.
No. As soon as I write one, I'm on to the next one or the next project. So I really kind of, it's odd. I'm sort of disassociated in my mind at some point, like who wrote that? And it's you know, because I'm always trying to move on to something else, the next big thing.
Have you, is writing your full-time career then?
No, I work for Vanderbilt University, so I have a full-time job. And I do writing just because I have to. You know, I could be going to football games on the weekends, but or you know, watching something television at night. But I don't know. It's just a need to write.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about your path to publication. So I'm guessing this need to write has been around for a while. Did it start when you were a teenager?
Yeah, probably my teens. My father and mother were big into history, and so I like history. So a lot of my reading is actually history books, biographies, and so I like doing the research. So the books I do write, I put a lot of research into them. This one is probably the least researched one I've done, although some of the events that happen in the Don Quixote Candide book are based on actual events. Like the town they start in, where they meet each other in northern France or northern Spain, is an actual town, and it's landlocked. It's a Spanish town landlocked on French soil. So I wanted to put them in a quirky town to kickstart this sort of offbeat, quirky book, and so that's how they ended up there. But my first book was through John F. Blair Publisher. It was called Lord Baltimore, and again, Don Quixote is the same number of syllables, and Don means Lord in Spanish, and so I just really patterned this book on Don Quixote, two people on the road getting into one scrape after another. And then the next book I did was an oral history of an island off the Georgia coast, St. Simon's Island. It's called Voices from St. Simon's, Personal Narratives of an Island's Past. So I interviewed former descendants of slaves, descendants of plantation owners who still live on that island. And so it's a compilation of narratives about the history of the island. Mm-hmm. And I followed that up with, I had extra interviews, so I followed it up with another book called Georgia Witness, which is an oral history about the state of Georgia. So I interview people from different parts of geographically around the state. Then the next book was called Rosebush. No, actually it's called Jesus Tree. Jesus Tree is about an actual story of a pastor who was murdered while sitting at his desk working on a sermon in 1938, I believe, during the Depression. The house is still standing. The people who knew about the murder, their sons and daughters are still there. So I transposed this to another town and wrote this story of this African-American who went to jail, sentenced for 40 years for the murder. He probably did not actually commit the murder. It was someone else. It was really murky, even today. But I told his story in this book called Jesus Tree.
Oh, wow.
And so it was dark for me to write. I had to sort of clean my palate and write another book called Rosebush, which is a more lighthearted romp about a chemical engineer who moves down to Georgia from Wisconsin to help save a paper mill. And he falls in love with an environmentalist who wants to do nothing to do with people that work at the paper mill. And then this book is also a further cleansing of the palate. You know, it was just such a the Jesus Tree was such a hard book to write. I'm still sort of getting over that.
Mm. Wow. So
up well. It's not a happy story. It does not end well.
It doesn't sound like it. Well, let's talk a little bit more about OMG, Don Quixote and Candide Seek Truth, Justice, and El Dorado in the Digital Age, LOL. And this is definitely a book where you need to suspend disbelief to really enjoy it.
Right.
But it's really fun. One of the, you know, of course, to give a little sort of what the storyline is, you have these two characters, Don Quixote and Candide, who are the actual characters, but they're still living. So in 21st century Europe.
Right.
Right.
Candide sort of questions that. existential crisis, like, how can this be? You know, how am I still alive and doing these things? And Don Quixote uses reason and logic to talk him through it. And it's like, come on, of course we're still alive doing things. People, you remember the Age of Giants and people in the Bible who lived hundreds of years? Why shouldn't we live hundreds of years?
And
he had to mansplain it to why they can still do these things and still go on adventures.
And the two of them decide they need a quest. They need to go on a quest, that they haven't done that in decades or centuries, and they're both up for a quest.
Go ahead. Well, yeah, Don has been living off his celebrity at different taverns and restaurants, and he's finally sick of it. You know, he wants to get back on the road and do something. Even if he dies in the attempt, it's better than the existence he was leading. And Candide, too, has that thirst to get back on the road and have adventure.
Now, one of the there's sort of this ongoing argument between the two of them of which of them is most famous. And the biographies about them, which most of us may consider novels, but they refer to them as biographies. Which one was the better seller?
Right.
And, of course,
go ahead.
Almost everybody is familiar with the story of Don Quixote. And yet we're, I think, a little less familiar with Candide.
And, well, you know, the beauty is you don't have to know the stories.
No, you don't.
Candide explains his whole saga in about two paragraphs, and then the characters they meet: Cyrano de Bergerac, Huck Finn, and Long John Silver, and the crew of the Star Trek series, and Elizabeth Bennett. You don't have to know these stories to read the book or to get the humor, and it is, you know, I'm influenced by a couple of writers, P.G. Woodhouse, and a couple of writers for a comedian. And I'll tell you, this is sort of a trick question. The comedian had a show where he played himself, and he had a female and two male sidekicks, and it was a show about nothing.
Jerry Seinfeld?
It's not Jerry Seinfeld. That's the trick question.
Ah.
His name is Tony Hancock, and he was doing this back in the 50s.
Wow.
40 years before Seinfeld, that formula was being used by Tony Hancock in England. And the two writers for that show were Ray Galton and Alan Simpson, two really good comedy writers, who, by the way, met each other at a tuberculosis clinic in England when they were young. And they went on to write other shows like Steptoe and Son, which was the precursor to Sanford and Son over here. And but that humor really has intrigued me. And so a lot of that humor, you call it Monty Python humor. I like P.G. Woodhouse and Tony Hancock and all that. It's sort of, that's the type of humor that's in this book.
And it's kind of in some ways, an intellectual humor, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little highbrow, just because the literature, to me, is a step up.
Right.
And I'm trying to match their voices if I can, which is a tall task. I even felt very intimidated by trying to do Dean Moriarty from On the Road, Iraq. I had to really work on that. I'm not sure I was even going to include it.
Wow.
Trying to ape the voices of these dead novelists and their characters was a challenge, but I kind of like doing that.
So
I wrote it with the intent that, well, you know, if no one likes this, it doesn't get published, no harm, no foul. But it was fun to write.
I bet. How did you decide what characters to bring in? Because essentially on this road trip, the two characters, Don Quixote and Candide, keep running into other mostly fictional characters. Some perhaps are real, but there's always this question about what's fictional and what's real. And also there's a question throughout the book about what's time and what time are we in? And there's quite a sort of jumping around in time. So, you know, the characters are everything from, which pirate was it that you?
Long John Silver.
Long John Silver. Like you said, the crew of Star Trek, Sherlock Holmes, Huck Finn and Mark Twain, someone from The Godfather. They're just all over the map. So how did you decide when to draw these different characters in?
Well, the key word there is the map. Put your finger on it. I knew they were starting in this town, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Lavia, in northern France, or northern Spain, southern France. And they wanted to go to El Dorado. Candide wanted to revisit El Dorado. And the only El Dorado I know is in Las Vegas, and the El Dorado Casino and Hotel. And so they head east. I'm sorry, west. And so the geography determined who they would run into next. So they're crossing France, and they ran into Cyrano de Bergerac, who's now a train conductor. And next they went to England and met Sherlock Holmes. That's who they were trying to find to begin with, because Candide heard he had all the answers to life's problems and helped solve riddles like, where is El Dorado now? And so they keep going west and just, you know, meeting people he would meet on that journey west. And coming back, they would meet people you would probably meet on that journey coming back east. So that sort of determined who they would run into next.
Okay.
As far as time goes, they are in a convergence, which to me, I think I made that up, I'm not sure, but I describe it as a time warp on steroids. And think of it as a Mobius strip, which is a sort of like a figure eight structure, and where time has no relevance. It can be the future or the past or the present. You could meet your great-great-grandfather who's been dead 100 years, or your great-great-great-granddaughter who hadn't been born yet. You can all have a conversation together because you're in this convergence where time is meaningless. So that was sort of a device to get them to different periods and eras. And they, you know, of course, they meet the crew of Star Trek, and they explain to them, yeah, this is normal. We deal with this all the time. And so, in fact, the Star Trek crew shows up at different periods in their lives because of this. They meet them at the first time where they're sort of at the peak of their careers, and then the second time when they're just beginning their careers, and then the third time when they're retired. And, Captain Kirk, Admiral, retired. And so, yeah, time has no meaning, so they could move around in time and space and meet all these different characters on their trip, going to Las Vegas and coming back.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Stephen Doster, author of OMG, Don Quixote and Candide Seek Truth, Justice, and El Dorado in the Digital Age, LOL. And, of course, OMG stands for Oh My God, and LOL for Laugh Out Loud. And one of the kind of recurring streams through the book is the idea that Candide, at least, is living in the digital age and has a smartphone and likes to blog on it. Tell me what your thinking was in putting that aspect into the book.
Yeah, I want to show that Candide is stayed current with technology and with the times, whereas Don Quixote is sort of maybe 100 years behind, you know, the curve, maybe 50 years, but he's just not quite up to speed with technology. And so that sort of reflects a lot of people in our culture. You know, you're either uber up to date on the latest operating systems and latest devices, which is sort of like a trap you're in, and then people who just sort of decide, you know what, I know what I know, and I know the technology I know. I'm going to stop there. I'm good. You know, I'm not going to try to keep up with it. So that's sort of that thinking is they're in the digital age. This is a current time period. Yet they're going through time to other places and meeting other characters.
And I got a kick out of the blog and how he was watching how many followers he had and
how few followers he had.
And then at some point he starts to get a few more. He gets a little more of a following. And what was it that attracted the following?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
It probably had to do with some horrible disaster.
Yeah. And the other thing that I really got a kick out of was how these two went from mega success to mega disaster and back and forth. It's like they'd make a fortune, lose a fortune, make a fortune, lose a fortune. And I've known people that seems to be the way they've lived their life.
Yeah, it's a boom or bust existence.
Yeah.
And part of it was actually based on, you know, Voltaire had a very tumultuous, I would say, life, sort of on the run from one monarch to another. And Cervantes, who wrote Don Quixote, he was actually a prisoner of a Moorish slave at one time, and had to be ransomed, and that's how they ended up on this boat as oarsmen. You know, they're slaves on this boat owned by this Arab sheikh, and so it's sort of a nod towards Cervantes' life and Voltaire's life. Sort of, I would say they were tumultuous, sort of up and down, which you know, over a period of time you would have these ups and downs, especially in their time periods. And Don, I don't know if you caught this, but he was sort of nonchalant about disasters.
Yes.
After 400 years, you know, things happen. People die in disasters, and there are horrible things. But you know, okay, I'm kind of over it. That's not me talking, that's Don Quixote from a 400-year-old person's perspective, whereas Candide is still aghast at the things that man does to men do to other men and or other people. So you got that sort of dynamic going. They're sort of different in that respect too.
And every time when, you know, they're in a real, you know, they really get themselves in a scrape, they're in a terrible situation, and then something happens to get them out of that, and then they end up the next time around in an even worse situation. And looking back at the previous bad situation and wishing that they'd be back there.
Yeah, anything to do with water, they would go in the water.
Yes.
On the Titanic sinks. They were flying over from Las Vegas to Houston, I think, and end up in a lake. And then they're on the Atlantic coming back on the return trip and end up, the boat sinks in the Bermuda Triangle. So, yeah. And then when they, right, after Long John Silver, they're on a raft, right? And they're picked up by Long John Silver and are made, you know, made to swab the decks. And then they are sold into slavery after that, and then they end up in the dungeon of this powerful ruler in North Africa. And Candide keeps saying, oh, you know, what a, how wonderful things were when we were being fed gruel.
Yeah.
Now we have nothing. We have crumbs. So, you know, but it gives you perspective. No matter how bad, yeah, you know, people say that, no matter how bad I have it, it's worse for other people. It could be worse.
Right.
And
right.
And they're living this. And of course, Don is like, this is just another thing that's happening. We'll get out of this. You know, trust me, just,
yeah.
You know.
And if we don't, no big deal.
Right, and if we don't, we're dying in a quest to save a damsel from distress, and what a better way to go.
And it was really, it was fun, too, that how hard he had to try to find a damsel in distress to to dedicate his journey to.
Yeah, Candide, I'm not sure he ever, Candide never really found someone to dedicate his quest to that I can recall. Maybe he did, but, and Don found a street urchin in London who, but, you know, the thing is, a lot of the time, Don Quixote was sort of under the spell of Merlin, who kept popping up, as, you know, at different times in the book. So, Don Quixote and Merlin had this ongoing, battle with each other. That goes back to the book Don Quixote, and so Merlin plays a role in this book as well. And Candide doesn't know when Don is under Merlin's spell and when he's not. And he, you know, and Don can't remember anything when he's under Merlin's spell. So he claims he's not accountable for his actions. Like, well, who would do that? Who would attack a windmill? That's crazy talk. And is he who would attack a windmill?
So I was curious about that, the Merlin thing. So that was from the original Man from La Mancha?
Yeah, yeah. He's in the original books that Cervantes did. There were two books. Now they're combined as one. The first one came out in 1605, and it was such a big hit. It started getting all these copycats, and he didn't like that, so he came back and killed Don Quixote off. I think a 13 or 12 version. And so, it was in one of those versions. Merlin's in that book.
Oh, wow. Wow. Now, but Merlin was... You know, Merlin's from the Camelot stories.
Right.
So were those sort of like stories that everybody knew at that time?
Yeah, I don't know. You would need to ask an English professor about that. You know, Cervantes and Shakespeare were contemporaries. They were writing at the same time period.
Interesting.
One of those, you know, what's in the water with all these, you know, bands coming out of England at the same time, or great writers out of the same little area of in New England or Georgia or wherever. You say, what's in the water? Well, you know, in the late 1500s, early 1600s, what was in the water that you produced Shakespeare and Cervantes at the same time?
And where did Cervantes live?
He was Spanish.
And was he writing in Spanish, probably?
Right, he was, yes.
Yeah.
He was a former soldier, and like I said, he was captured for ransom at one time. I think he was enslaved for like 5 years.
Wow.
So he, you know, when he started writing Don Quixote, he knew what he was talking about as far as life's ups and downs. And so I'm, you know, I, like you mentioned earlier, the two characters in my book look at their authors as biographers.
Right, right.
Authors. And as usual, they think they got it wrong, like I've been misrepresented. And if you read some of, or look at some of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories on Sherlock Holmes, he's always saying, my biographer, Watson, doesn't get it right. He romanticizes everything I do. It should be an instructional case study. And so even Sherlock Holmes under Conan Doyle complained about his biographer. So I'm sort of adopting that, like, you know, if someone wrote your life story, you would probably take issue, unless you were involved with the actual writing. You'd say, you know, they didn't get that right.
Yeah, yeah.
So Don's feels the same way. He was misrepresented, that all Cervantes wrote about him were the follies and the horrible things that happened, not all the great triumphs. Like, you know, most inventors, they go through all these failures before they have triumphs. And he said, they misrepresented my whole life story.
Mm. How about Candide? Did he feel the same way?
You know, I can't remember if he really got into that or complained much about his treatment, but yeah, he did. He tried to convince Don that, yeah, I had a book written about me too. It's called Candide by this author named Voltaire, and or this biographer, and it was a big seller. It's never out of print, and Don doesn't believe them. So they go to a bookstore in France, and by golly, there's no books about him in the bookstore. There are a few about Don Quixote, and I won't reveal why, but, you know, there was a shortage because there's such a demand. Candide's book, but he still can't convince Don that he's well known and he's actually, you know, done some things noteworthy in his life.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Stephen Doster, author of OMG, Don Quixote and Candide, Seek Truth, Justice and El Dorado in the Digital Age, LOL. So tell me a little bit more about Candide and Voltaire, because I'm really not as familiar with them.
Well, the book Candide, the original name was something like Candide, All for the Best or The Optimist, and it was based on Leibniz's optimism. Leibniz, I forget his first name, but it was this idea that all is for the best of all possible worlds, so that no matter what happens, it's all for the best. And like your nose was designed specifically to hold glasses, you know, reading glasses, that kind of thing. No, mm-hmm. No matter what goes wrong, you can always find a silver lining or reason why it's all for the best. And so Candide, in the book Candide by Voltaire, he goes, he's kicked out of this German castle for, I think he had an affair with the maid, somebody in the castle. So he's kicked out, made the daughter of the prince, and he goes on this adventure to South America, to El Dorado, becomes very rich and loses it all, ends up on a farm with these people he met on his journey. And so he also meets them on this journey in my book, and Don Quixote also meets up with Sancho Panza again. So they meet the characters from the original books in this book as well. and Candide, he's having a sort of a turnabout. He's lost faith in this idea that all is for the best. And he's played in my book by this all is good idea that you see a lot of times. That, you know, people say it's all good.
Yeah.
And he sort of can't get away from that. So there's the two mind thoughts, that things are not all good, and then, you know, it's all good.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. So the concept for this book, was it something that sort of arrived fully formed for you, or was there just a seed of an idea? And if so, how did it grow?
Yeah, the seed was, I mentioned I went to this bookstore and Roger Bishop handed me Don Quixote, and I I had an interview with on Georgia Public Radio with a guy named St. John Smith, and we talked about similar books, picaresque novels and similar titles. And on the way home, I was thinking, well, who would Don Quixote team up with if he ever went on the road, like, you know, Bob Hope and Bing Crosby or Thelma and Louise, two people on the road. And maybe a few years ago, I got the idea. I was rereading Candide, and I thought maybe Candide and Don Quixote could go on the road together. So that was the kernel of the idea. And it built just by me finding this this little town in France that was a Spanish town surrounded by French soil, and I just started building it from there. And it's sort of like actually getting in a car, getting on the road with no final destination in mind, and just going. And, you know, so what happened next? You know, they catch a bus, and they head for somewhere where they can get on a train to go to Paris. And from there, they catch a boat to England. And from there, they catch a Titanic to the U.S. And from there, they meet the crew of the Star Trek, and who are trying to get down to Cape Canaveral to hijack a
shuttle.
To get back into space, because they've got Klingons attacking them, and they're back on Earth to save the planet once more. And I wrote it as I went, and I was going to end it with them leaving Nueva Mancha, which is the island that Sancho Panza was governor on. And I was going to end it there, but my agent said, no, you got to keep going. This is, you can't stop there. So so now they're in the middle of the ocean, the shark chewing on their raft, and what happens next? And that's where Long John Silver came in. So, it could have gone in any direction at any point.
How long did you spend writing it?
Well, I do a lot of writing at work as part of my job, but so I don't spend a lot of time writing at night on my own. But I try to get in a couple of hours on the weekend and maybe a half hour at night.
So what is your job that you get to write for your job?
A lot of it is content management, web content.
Ah.
And, promoting events here, things like that.
Okay. All right. And so if you're only writing a couple hours a weekend and maybe half an hour at night, does that mean that writing a book stretches out over a year or more?
Oh, yeah. This book probably took 6 months, because I could really knock it out. There was no research really involved. A lot of the other books take a lot of research, so I'm doing a lot of reading when I should be writing. but once I'm ready to write, I'm ready to go, because I've read up on it.
Reading and or getting, let's say, getting lost in the research, I think, is a danger for any writer that's writing either nonfiction or fiction that's got a historical aspect or something where you have to research to get the details right. It can be pretty easy to just keep following the rabbit hole, keep on going down the rabbit hole of research, and who knows where you end up. And sometimes you end up with something that you never thought you were looking for, but is just perfect for the book. And sometimes you end up just wasting time.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know about other people, but I could research all the time. That could be my full-time thing. Because it's so interesting to me. You just, like you said, you go down one rabbit hole and you come to another and you go down that. So at some point, you got to just have the discipline to say, you know what, I got to start writing. I got to get back to the keyboard and start putting it down.
Now, are you the type of writer who, when you're writing, just kind of writes really quickly, gets as much down on the page as you can, doesn't stop to edit as you go, or are you the kind that likes every sentence to be perfect before you go to the next one?
Yeah, I try to paint it like a canvas and just get the base down and then come back and edit later. And I even have to stop myself from editing so much because, you know, I'm not writing, I'm not getting it down.
Mm.
So, and the other thing is, there was, who was that artist? He had that TV show. He had the sort of the afro hair. Bob, what's his name? You know, he was on PBS. He had this.
Oh, the really paint, great... the painter guy?
What's that?
The guy who painted?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember his name either, but I know who you're talking about.
Well, he said once, you need two tools to paint. You need a paintbrush and a hammer, so you can hit yourself in the head and tell you when to stop. And I think that's true of writing, too. At some point, you got to stop. You got to close it out and finish up. And so one reason I don't like to read my books is because I'll never stop editing. And I really don't read them after they're done because I want to sit there and start redlining it. And why do you use this word or this phrase? Or why don't you move that paragraph over here? Or, you know, I was at a book show once, and the guy next to me, the author, was redlining his own book as he was about to read it. He was up next. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm editing." I said, "It's done. You know, it's published."
Oh, wow.
And let it go. And I'm like that too. I just
Well, do you enjoy the editing part?
No, that's work. writing is fun.
So researching is the most fun, writing is the second fun, and editing's the work.
Yeah, editing is work.
Yeah. And editing is what makes a writer.
Well, I guess it's what makes a good writer.
Yeah. Yeah.
or if you're lucky, you have a good editor who will because not all writers are good editors.
That's true.
All writers are good spellers.
Well, fortunately, these days with spell check, that doesn't matter quite as much as it used to.
Yeah, it's sort of a trap, too, because spell check and autocorrect can mess you up.
Oh, they sure can.
And, you know, so... you still need some good eyeballs on the paper, on the page, and the more the better.
That is true. Do you have anyone that you work with as you're writing to edit or give you feedback?
Yeah, my wife, she's good at that, and some friends, but she's more reliable as far as turning it around and getting it back to me.
That's important. How about a writer's group? Have you ever been part of a writer's group?
I have not. And then I was with a screenwriter's group for a little bit. But no, not a writer's group.
Now, your book is referred to as satire. What makes it satire, and how is that different from other types of writing you've done?
Mm. You know, I think satire is just being a wiseacre. I think if I could define it that way, it's humor, it's biting or cutting or observational, but... maybe that's innate in me to do that, to go that route. Like I said, this was fun. It sort of just flowed off my fingers. And whereas the other books have been a lot of research, a lot of upfront work, and this was more just have a good time. And I hope readers will. I think you got the right perspective. It should be a fun book. Don't take it too seriously. You know, it's just if you're an English major, you might have problems because the characters aren't, maybe they're a little bit out of character. But I just want people to have fun with this and forget their troubles and have something where they can a little place where they can go and not worry about world events or what's going on in their lives.
Well, you know, I tend to think of satire as being sort of a form of criticism almost.
Yeah.
But I didn't really feel that from this book. It almost felt like it was friendly satire rather than biting satire.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's, and Voltaire, I think, was sort of the master of satire, which is probably what got him in trouble a lot. But I think it's more, to me, it's more humor, I would say, than satire.
Yeah, yeah. And now, are the books, your previous books, do they all have an element of humor? It doesn't sound like they do, actually.
they do. The Jesus Tree does not. There might be a couple of places in there where you would chuckle, but it's a dark story. Someone who's innocent went to jail, and people who committed the murder went free. And this character is coming back after 40 years of serving time to meet the murderer, who's the richest man in town, and confront him because he's worried about both their souls because they killed this pastor together. He allowed it to happen, and the other guy actually did the murder. So that was sort of a, like I said, a hard one to write. But I would say the others, especially Rosebush, is pretty humorous.
How about the oral histories?
No, those are pretty straightforward. Recounting their lives and the things they went through in Depression era, Jim Crow era.
Well, what modern writers? You talked about Tony Hancock and the writers for that show as being someone you emulate. But in terms of book writers, humorous book writers, are there any other current ones that?
Can you name some for me?
I can't think of any right off the top of my head. Well, you know, there's certainly nonfiction one, the Dave Barrys and David Sedaris.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, those guys.
I haven't read their works. I'm familiar with them through Sedaris through public radio. And Barry through, some other venues. I haven't read his books. I did read Louis Grizzard when I was growing up. He was big in the South and in Georgia. But what I read now are historians or history books.
Wow. So in a sense, you seem to you sort of bring this element of humor into. Into some books that were serious to begin with. You know, some of these characters were kind of serious characters, and you bring this element of humor into those stories.
Yeah, maybe I'm like Don Quixote. After 400 years, I just have a different perspective. And maybe studying history, you get that perspective that, you know, bad things happen, but overall, you know, things worked out.
And of course, one of the greatest humor writers of all time, I would say the greatest, but is Mark Twain.
Yeah.
And you give a nod to him in your book as well.
Well, you know, Twain was heavily influenced by Cervantes. You read his books and Don Quixote, and you'll see the similarities.
I never thought about that.
And P.G. Woodhouse was a fan of Mark Twain's. So there's sort of this lineage going on there. I'm on the tail end of all this, and
I'm kind of trying to tie up the circle.
The beneficiary of their work and their humor, yeah.
So now, tell us about how this book was published, who your publisher is, and how you found them, or they found you.
Argus Publishing in North Carolina is the publisher. William Connor is the editor, and I got to them through and they had done another book of mine, which I haven't mentioned yet, about, actually it's about my mother. her World War II experiences, and she served as in the RAF as a WAF in mm-hmm. the Second World War, and assigned. She was on 8 RAF bases, Royal Air Force bases, and met Winston Churchill, and had a pretty interesting experience then. So they published this book. It's called Her Finest Hour, which, by the way, at the time, there was no other title called Her Finest Hour, which I couldn't believe. why would there not be 18 books called Her Finest Hour? Now there's a few more with that title, but Argus published that book for me, and Jeannie Locano got this book to them, too, and they said, yeah, we'll do that, too.
Well, that sounds like it was fairly painless.
Yeah.
Now, how about for your first book, getting it published, was that a little more of a arduous?
Yeah, I bought a copy of The Writer's Market and just started going alphabetically down the line, A through Z. And fortunately, Blair Publishing, which is now owned by Wren Books, liked it and decided to publish it. But I had probably maybe 112 rejection notices by the time they sent their letter to Seymour and talk to me. I even got a rejection letter a year later by a publisher that went out of business briefly and came back in business and saw my letter and rejected me. And it's already published. As far as rejection, that's just it means you're one step closer to the open door, the one door you need to go through.
So you never got discouraged?
No, because I was not published to begin with, and if I get published, that's great. If I don't, well, I got a job, I got my life, I'll keep going.
Would you have kept writing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was writing already before I decided, hey, this might be publishable. So I think all the writing, you go through a lot of bad writing to get to something where you say this could be publishable. And even then, after a few books you get under your belt, you go, I think I'm getting better.
Well, they do say practice makes perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, so I appreciate the rejections of the really horrible things that should not be in print. The gatekeepers did their job at that time.
Had you tried to publish things earlier?
I think so. And I forget. I don't think they were nonfiction works. So, but I just wasn't there yet, as far as having something that's marketable. And even publishers will tell you they have limited budgets. Even Bennett Cerf, who co-founded Random House, he would tell certain authors, we got X dollars to promote our authors and our books, and we have some proven authors over here. They're proven. That's where our money's going to go. And we got some new people who we think are up-and-comers, and you're not getting much of this promotional budget. And he didn't say it that way, but that's how they broke it down. And for a lot of publishers, they got to decide, who am I going to promote? And the others, you're sort of on your own to, use whatever social media platforms you can to get the word out.
Do you like that part of the job? Of course, you have to say yes since you're talking to me, but...
No, I don't. I like writing. I like research. Having to wear the...
So the marketing is not your favorite part of it.
Which is ironic because I'm in marketing. Major, there's that verse in the Bible, let someone else, or don't brag, let someone else say good things about you. And anyway, it's sort of that dynamic between, me beating my chest and saying, hey, world, look at this, and being raised to say, don't brag.
Well, that's true. That's true. And I think some authors you know, the whole marketing aspect, the like doing the interviews and so forth, even though they may enjoy it in some respects, it's taking time away from the next book.
Yeah, yeah. I'd rather be working on the next book than going out and plugging the...
So what is the next book for you?
I'm working on a book for University of Georgia Press about a barrier island called Cumberland Island off the Georgia coast. It's just north of Florida. And it's got a history going way back to the Tamucua Indians who lived there a couple of thousand years ago, to the Spanish missions that were there in the 1500s, to plantation days, and to the present. It's where John Kennedy Jr. got married. Remember when he snuck off and had that quiet wedding or private wedding? That's the island they went to.
Mm.
Okay. It's going to be a four-color photography / narration of the history of that island.
And where are you in the process of writing that one? How far along are you?
I'm probably a third of the way through it. I am still doing research, but writing as I go. And fortunately, I'm like 200 feet from away from the Vanderbilt Central Library, which has much of the work I need in that library.
Wow.
Amazingly, they have a lot of the Georgia history and Florida history. And if they don't have it, I can get it through interlibrary loan.
Well, Stephen, that sounds like a great project, and wish you great luck with it. Do you have any, we just have about a minute left, do you have any words of advice for people who want to write and publish?
Yeah, publishing, I don't know how to get published. I told you how I got published. Can't give advice on anyone else how they would get it. You know, if you can get an agent, that is like a big step up. As far as writing, a tip that I think might be useful is when you are writing at the end of the day and you're at a good point where you're excited about what you're going to write next, stop there and give yourself something to look forward to when you pick up your pen the next day. That way you're starting sort of on a peak, not heading uphill. You're sort of like just gliding downhill. I'm excited about this new thing. And if you get a writing block, take a walk or a long drive, and something will come to you.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Writer's Voices, Stephen.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that was Stephen Doster, author of OMG, Don Quixote and Candide Seek Truth, Justice, and El Dorado in the Digital Age, LOL. And that's written under the pseudonym Stefan Soto. So if you're looking for that book, wherever books are sold. So we have just a moment, so stay tuned. Coming up, we have Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. And I have a closing quote from Mark Twain, which is, get your facts first, then you can distort them as you please. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.